Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Aaron Van Oort, representing Allianz. May it please the court. For 11 years, Mr. Rothman was Allianz's lawyer. As its lawyer, he was admitted to their closest confidences on how to deal with agent misconduct. They shared with him their procedures for monitoring. They asked him to assess those procedures. They sought his advice. And when regulators asked about the procedures, they hired him to defend them and to negotiate them. In this case, though, Mr. Rothman is purporting and wanting to offer the testimony that those same procedures from that same time period were legally deficient. The standard that is applied by every court, whether state or federal, that has addressed this kind of issue precludes turning against a client like this on an issue where you had confidences.
You refer to this as the traditional rule, and your opponent refers to it as the federal rule. It seems like is it more accurate to describe it as a developing rule? It doesn't seem to be entrenched enough to call it traditional to me.
It started in the 80s when experts began being used in a more advocate way. That was the first time it came up in both state and federal courts. But I'll grant you, we're about 30 years in.
Now, your opponent says that, look, this rule has its roots. The rule that you propose has its roots in professional responsibility rules about representing clients in serial litigation. Why not go back, when we're talking about lawyers, why not go back to that place where it all began when the lawyer is the expert? Why not apply different rules for lawyers and non-lawyers given the unique setting of the lawyer in the development of the rule?
Yeah, it's an interesting argument, isn't it? And as we said in the reply brief, they agree that if you're acting as a lawyer before and a lawyer now, you'll be disqualified because there's a substantial relationship. If you're an expert before and an expert now, you'll be disqualified if there's a substantial relationship. But if you're a lawyer before and an expert now, you're only disqualified if you can prove a use. And what they haven't explained is why there should be any gap for that particular circumstance. You're right, Your Honor, that the rule for experts who are not lawyers was developed by reference to the rules governing lawyers. But the rule that it was by reference to was the rule requiring disqualification if there's a substantial relationship before and after, not the rule requiring a specific proof of use. Because as we cited, every single court that has said, if the subject matter before and the subject matter now is related, use is inevitable.
Do you feel at all awkward? Respondent makes a point that, if applying your rule would mean that a lawyer might be eligible to be actually representing an opponent of a former client, but be disqualified as an expert witness in presumably a less invasive role than as a lawyer. Do you agree that your rule does allow for that in the right circumstances? And if so, does it trouble you, or does it trouble your argument?
No, I don't agree. Under the rule we're proposing, you'd be disqualified as both.
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, just to be clear, if Mr. Rothman were the lawyer for the plaintiffs here, not the expert, he'd be disqualified in a heartbeat under Rule 1.9A.
But don't you have to show the substantial relationship?
Exactly.
But your argument is, I think the rule that you're applying isn't substantial related, but just particularly related to. It's more of a general relationship.
I don't think...
Is that what the case law, applying the what you call the traditional standard, doesn't it look at whether the matters are related, not substantially related?
Yeah. I think the courts have used a variety of language about it, and I agree, Your Honor, that some courts have not talked specifically about what the nature of the relationship has to be. Most of the cases that don't talk expressly about the relationship involve somebody who switched sides in the very same case, and so it was obvious it was the same. And that's why we say, when we talk about the standard, all of the courts that have done this have either expressly or implicitly required that relationship, and we think that's the right way to approach it.
Now, let's assume for my argument, and I hope you don't lose your thought because I want you to come back to
that's
it.
That's fine, Your Honor.
Assume for my question, though, that we would believe that there is a difference between substantial relationship and the related to standard that these cases that you cite advocate for. And therefore, you could have a circumstance where a lawyer could qualify as an opposing attorney, but not as an expert witness. Does that trouble your argument?
No. Let me be clear. We are not asking, Your Honors, to create a tighter standard for lawyers serving as experts than lawyers serving as lawyers. We're not asking that. To the extent that any other case has done that, we don't think you should adopt that approach. The approach we think you should adopt is the one that would say, if you're disqualified as a lawyer, you're going to be disqualified also as an expert. And it goes back to the fundamental reason for doing this, that the logic the courts apply is they say, if what you did before, if the confidences you got, the privileged information you got in your prior one speaks to the same issues that you're testifying about now as an expert in addressing, then you have to be disqualified because there's no way the human brain...
Even if it's not substantially related.
Well, Your Honor, the modifier, you can pick whatever modifier you want. If it's the same thing, then you're disqualified. And our argument in this case is it's the same thing.
So point us in the direction, because it seems like the issue here is that this agent engaged in criminally fraudulent conduct.
Yep.
So it's not just suitability of an annuity product, you know, based on somebody's wealth and age. What is in the record to tie it to what are really the issues in this particular case?
Yeah, the specific spot in the record is pages 19 through 22 of our addendum. It's the affidavit of Mr. Scott Bowman, who is the vice president and deputy GC of Allianz and who hired Mr. Rothman and worked with him. And I want to be very specific here. Plaintiffs claim in their amended complaint is that Allianz should have detected what Mr. Meadows was doing through tighter screening for surrenders, that is giving back annuities that were already bought, and replacements. It's paragraphs 174 and 175 of the amended complaint. That's their negligence theory. They said if you had had tighter procedures for screening for suitability and replacements and surrenders, you would have caught him.
And he gave advice and counsel on those procedures.
He did. It's directly in Mr. Bowman's affidavit. And then also at page 20 of our reply brief, we cite the specific part of the record where we list all of the policies and procedures for screening for replacements, for screening for surrenders. And they're called things like agent oversight committee and agent oversight misconduct that we produced to them and that he advised on and that now he's testifying are inadequate. So their legal theory. So go ahead, Your Honor.
So it's your position that the district court erred when it found that trying to find the exact language, but on page 14 of the addendum, that Allianz's failure to cite any opinions in the Rothman report directly related to his former representation of Allianz also undermines, can you help me pronounce the name?
Yes.
Emirati's concern about its ability to cross-examine Rothman rigorously.
Yeah, Emirati is the other party that's not involved in this appeal, Your Honor. On that, but you're right. As an alternative ruling below, the district court said that it didn't think that what Mr. Rothman was doing here was substantially related to his prior representation. At the beginning of the opinion, the district court said it wasn't making any findings of fact expressly, and so we don't think there's factual deference. But to the extent there were, that was clearly wrong. And the reason is so I've gone through what plaintiff's theory is. Their plaintiff's is a negligence theory and said if your procedures for reviewing for surrenders and suitability were stricter, you would have caught him. Now, what Mr. Rothman is opining on, and this is at pages 52 and 53 of our addendum, his specific opinions, I'm going to read them. One, Allianz, quote, failed to establish a system of suitability replacement surveillance and control that was adequate. That's his opinion here. His second opinion, Allianz could have and should have designed more stringent surrender thresholds and a system to catch improper high rates of surrender. That's his opinion. When he was their lawyer, he advised them on their systems for monitoring agents for improper surrender. And he advised them on their systems for monitoring suitability. Those were the policies.
So if there is a would be a factual dispute, is the court, I mean, there's almost everything's redacted except for subjects, and then there's some general allegations in the general counsel's affidavit you just cited to, yes. Declaration. So is the district court then to just rely on the allegations of Allianz, if we were to say, oh, the court used the wrong standard and remanded, yeah. or, I mean, I'm assuming Mr. Rothman would take the position and respondents would take the position that that Mr. Rothman, in fact, could go ahead yeah. and under rule point, you know, 1.9, as the attorney and not be disqualified. I don't know if that's their position or not, but then how is the district court to judge whether the substantial relatedness of the representation versus what he's opining about as an expert?
Yeah, I'll give you two answers. One comes from the commentary to our rules, and the other is what courts have done. The commentary to the rules, it's comment 3 to rule 1.9, specifically addresses this issue, Your Honor. And what it says is a former client is not required to reveal the confidential information learned by the lawyer in order to establish a substantial risk that the lawyer has confidential information to use in the subsequent matter. Instead, what the comment says, it's sufficient to show the, quote, nature of the services and the information that would be learned in the ordinary course. This speaks right to it, of course. If you're forced to disclose your privileged information to protect it, it kind of defeats the purpose. That's what this comment says. And as a practical matter, every court that has addressed this, and we've cited it there, say that once you show the substantial relationship between the subject matters, the expert or lawyer's assurance that they won't use that part of it is not enough.
So the fact that the district court sort of cautioned Mr. Rothman by saying he must continue to take care not to use any information relating to his prior representation is not satisfying to Allianz?
No, that's correct. You can't, in all the courts that have said this recognize, you can't build a Chinese wall in your own head. You can't compartmentalize information. Once you show that it's this closely related like it is here, we're done.
This is a unique case in one regard that I didn't see in any of the federal cases that you cited, which is this role that Mr. Rothman played in the Commerce Department.
Right.
Arguably adverse to Allianz in the interim. How does that factor into the analysis, and how would it factor into the rule that you're asking us to apply?
Because, I mean, I would just add to that because the attorney-client privilege can be waived.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. So and you're right that this would come up. It would be a waiver argument. It said you already gave it away back then, and therefore there's nothing left to assert now. The short answer to that is that when Mr. Rothman was the Commerce Commissioner, he never issued an opinion that Allianz's procedures on this were adverse. He never got into this same subject matter while he was the commissioner, and so it just didn't come up. The longer answer on this is that the rules that govern experts in courts are not the same rules that apply to government officials. In the government official context, where you are the Commissioner of Commerce overseeing all of that, they have their own rules of conduct, but you're not in front of a court to be enforceable on this. And so, factually, it didn't come up because he wasn't directly adverse on this subject, and legally the rules were different. As soon as we saw, by the way, that Mr. Rothman said in this case that he was claiming that there was some adversity of the same kind, we sent him a letter and saying, hold on, we didn't realize you thought you were adverse to us on these issues. If you had told us that, we would have said right now, we're preserving our privilege.
Can I ask you?
Yeah, my time's up, but I'm glad to answer.
Do you mind if I ask him
no,
one more
please
question?
Go ahead.
I may send him over the deadline a little bit, or the timeline a little bit. But I didn't fully grasp, and I'd like you to develop, just for, if you could do it briefly, the interest of the integrity of the proceedings argument as to cross-examination and how your client, you believe, would be restricted in cross-examining Mr. Rothman in a trial.
Yeah. Yeah, and here's the nature of that argument. The argument in favor of disqualification is that our confidential and privileged information is necessarily implicated. In order to show and cross-examine and basically say to him, you know, what changed? How can you possibly be saying this now? And there, we would have to make the choice to disclose more privileged information. If we choose to protect our privilege, our cross-examination is limited. If we're going to go full out and cross-examine, then we're being forced to waive the privilege. So
if he had been an expert, if he had represented some other client and provided advice, you could then get into that advice and cross-examine him on the credibility.
Yeah, to the extent that we had access to it. Right. And the same argument applies with confidentiality agreements. And so the case that we've cited in our briefing.
Why don't you just finish up quickly, because we
I'm sorry.
Time.
I just wanted to provide the closest citation. It's the Calendar Research case. It's in our reply brief at page 24, note 3. And that case specifically addresses this risk being forced to waive a privilege.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Catherine Barrett-Wick, Best and Flanagan, here today on behalf of respondents' plaintiffs. Also with me today are my co-counsel Amy Connors and Brian Linneruth. The Court should affirm the District Court's order refusing to disqualify former Insurance Commissioner Mike Rothman as the plaintiff's expert on liability. The District Court used the correct legal standard, applying the rules of professional conduct that govern attorneys and their duties to former clients. The District Court also did not abuse its discretion in making factual findings that the scope of Mr. Rothman's limited role in this case as an adverse testifying expert was not substantially related to his representation more than a decade ago of Allianz on compliance, sort of regulatory matters relating to annuities.
In applying the rules of professional responsibility.
That is correct.
So that seems to be the heart of the case. So I want to your brief sort of criticizes your opponents, or you characterize it as the federal rule, as if it doesn't apply to states, but I have seen several states that have adopted this rule. I didn't see any citation in your brief to a different rule that states tend to apply or that Minnesota would apply. I gather you weren't able to find any cases.
That's correct. We've cited the most relevant cases that we have found. We think the Commonwealth case, I think that's actually federal. Yeah, it is. That was the closest case that we could find to these facts, where there was a former attorney who had done some meaningful work, but on unrelated issues and quite a few years before. So all of the cases.
Well, when you say on unrelated issues and quite a few years before, I mean, the negligence claim sort of jumped off the page, to me anyway, when I considered how the defense counsel would want to defend that claim and defend its policies as not being negligent and being protective of people in your client's shoes. And it seems like, at least as represented to the district court, that was very much in the nature of the representation of Mr. Rothman or the service of Mr. Rothman in providing counsel to Allianz.
So I have a couple of responses to that, Your Honor. So the first is that the particular opinions of Mr. Rothman here that would support the negligence claim relate specifically to Sean Meadows. I believe Judge Siegel correctly phrased it as the criminal conduct. And that was not sort of the fine-tooth red flag analysis surveillance That was not the kind of representation that Mr. Rothman was doing. He was providing guidance to them on, and again, we just know this through the same pleadings you've had a chance to see, the high-level guidance about the sort of policies that Allianz needed to set up. Now, my second response
is... But to catch problems, right?
Yes.
And wasn't it the flipping of these annuities and selling one and buying another? Isn't that the very conduct that you're claiming that Allianz should have caught?
So, particular Sean Meadows, yes. There's nothing in the record.
But that's based on policies and practices. That's how a corporation implements its work, correct?
That is. I could direct your honor to additional language in comment 3 of rule 1.9 that talks about when an attorney has formally represented an organization, that general knowledge about the policies, about kind of high-level policies of that organization, especially if it's become known to the public or rendered obsolete, does not prevent them from representing an adverse party in subsequent proceedings.
Your client, as I understand it, Mr. Rothman did not just provide counsel. As I understand it, he was outside litigation counsel as well, either directing or participating in litigation on behalf of Allianz on issues somewhat related to these.
Well, including, I mean, that you cite to the 2007, the Minnesota Attorney General case, correct, as part of the evidence of why, I mean, it's in Mr. Rothman's report, right?
So he doesn't discuss that. It is a material that he reviewed. He doesn't base any of his opinions on that. And that was a publicly available document. I also want to make a point.
He was involved in that litigation on behalf of Allianz, correct?
That's absolutely right. That was the number one piece.
Isn't it possible that Allianz might want to cross-examine him regarding issues relating to that as part of this litigation?
Well,
given it's cited in your complaint or your amended complaint?
If you look carefully at his opinions, he simply doesn't rely upon that in making his core opinions relating to the failure to catch the red flags about Sean Meadows.
So therefore, Allianz, what does that have to do with whether Allianz makes a strategic decision to cross-examine him on it? You're saying that they don't need to.
Well, so this issue came up in and it's in the Ms. Connor's declaration of the record. We initially sought discovery into information relating to that 2007 AG report, and Allianz took the position that was unrelated to this Meadows litigation, and we did not pursue any further discovery, and that's the fact that the district court made note of. So in that way and in several other ways, we see Allianz really changing its position. During discovery, they said discovery into agent policies were not relevant because it didn't show things relating particular to Sean Meadows, and that general policies weren't relevant. They took a narrow view in defending this case in discovery, and for that reason, we see that the documents produced relate substantially to Mr. Meadows, our own client's investments, or ultimately they did produce some sort of general policies. But they have continued to reframe the scope of what this case is really about, and only now when they are trying to take out plaintiff's preferred expert do they suddenly say that these high-level issues are at play.
But to prove your claim, don't you have to prove there's something wrong with Allianz's policies and procedures?
You do, but to repeat the way that you had framed it earlier, this is an issue of criminal fraud. And Mr. Rothman...
Mr. Meadows is the issue of criminal fraud.
Absolutely.
But the question of what policies would protect against it, maybe general policies that aren't necessarily fine-tuned to fraud, but maybe general concerns. And when you have a general negligence claim, it seems to me to be exactly the kind of issue the jury would hone in on, the lawyers would hone in on, and the examination should hone in on.
Under these circumstances, I don't think so, because the crux of our negligence claim is really not so much that it's really that they didn't follow their existing policies as to Mr. Meadows, that there were all of these red flags going back years and years that he was someone that they should have been keeping an eye on and that they simply didn't do that. And the surrender policy in particular, that is one of the more relevant policies, that was developed after Mr. Rothman's tenure as our outside counsel. And I just, to go back to the point I was making about the shifting scope of relevant discovery, it's an important fact, and the district court relied on this in its findings, that nothing on the privilege aug from Allianz, and nothing privilege in this case, was earlier than the spring of 2014. And that was long after Mr. Rothman had been serving as insurance commissioner.
Can I stop you just for one quick second here? So paragraph 94 of the Rothman report says that Allianz's compliance procedures for surveillance of surrender activity were inadequate and flawed. And so were those policies developed after Mr. Rothman left? And do you know whether or not his legal advice contributed to the change in that policy, if in fact it's a new policy since he was no longer counsel?
There are no facts about that in the record, and Allianz certainly has made no such specific claims. And when at the district court level...
How does that work to your favor?
Because Allianz has the obligation to demonstrate that Mr. Rothman's testimony would use or refer to or divulge confidential information. And only at the appellate court, before the district court, they did not cite any specific part of his report. They just said, full stop, he should
be
excluded.
That's, by the way, if we apply the professional rule, not the
Correct.
Federal rule.
Yep.
Well, can I ask you about, I just have a big picture question that's troubling me. On that element in the federal rule, sometimes it's folded into the second element and sometimes is the third element, the idea of the integrity of the judicial proceedings. Yeah. I'm concerned that there's a sort of an inherent prejudice that might invite plaintiff's lawyers to go out and seek general counsel, former general counsel, former outside counsel of former represented, now opposing party, simply for the opportunity to put the witness on the stand and ask the question, which I presume will be asked of Mr. Rothman, in your role as developing qualifications as an expert, who have some of your clients been? You've represented the opposing party. Doesn't that concern you that jurors would naturally tend to credit an expert because that expert now has taken a position adverse to a former client? Isn't that an inherent danger that might affect the integrity of judicial proceedings?
I don't see that being any danger that the consistent enforcement of the professional rules to attorneys in all contexts couldn't fix. So Mr. Rothman can't escape, nor is he attempting to, his obligations to his former client simply by having a hat in this case as an expert. So I actually think the consistent application of Rule 1.9, I think the court was right that 1.9C is the most applicable here, the consistent application of that, even when an attorney is subsequently an attorney expert and not an attorney.
How does that satisfy my concern? My concern is regarding this general notion that analogy is the... This is off topic a bit, but the commercial by the guy, you remember the guy in the commercial, the Verizon commercial, he used to walk around saying, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? And now he's switched. The competitor's got him. And why? Because the audience, the consumer would say, well, he used to represent that other client. Now he must have some inside information. It makes his position more credible now. It seems to me that every expert who flips and represents an opinion contrary to a former client would necessarily carry that extra credibility, and that seems to be that's a problem for me.
Okay, I hear the concern, and I regret I didn't address it sufficiently the first time. I don't think that's anything that. Why can't cross examination fix that? Just like
How?
Any other, by articulating that he used to represent. You know, why can't they be used to kind of, as they're frankly trying to do here, impugn him for testifying against his former client.
But their argument, though, is that that would involve divulging attorney-client privileged information. So can I, because there's not much time left, ask you a question?
Yes.
Appellant takes the position that Mr. Rothman would be disqualified under 1.9 from actually representing the plaintiffs, the respondents in this case. And do you agree with that or not, and why?
Absolutely do not agree.
In 30 seconds or less.
2 seconds or less.
No. You've got time. You've got a couple minutes.
The district court found to the contrary, and it was not an abuse of discretion.
The district court found under 1.9C, that which deals with youth. And wouldn't you agree that 1.9C is a perfect guidance if a lawyer goes out and works for a competitor, for example, and becomes vice president of marketing? And even though they represented and they were in-house for or outside counsel for Allianz before, they can do this job, even though it's a direct competitor, as long as they're not using confidential information. That makes sense to me. But in the situation where they're directly adverse in a courtroom, how do we get around Judge Ross's concern? And maybe we don't. But why don't you wrap up?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, so, I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely. Judge Cochran wants to ask a question.
Go ahead and answer.
I know.
I wanted to make sure that the court understood when I said that the district court made a finding. The district court did make a finding about substantial relationship and found that there was none, and that's why I feel the district court's decision did find that Mr. Rothman could actually play the role of adverse counsel in this action. And so that was what I was referring to. I think, so the idea that a client can capture an attorney in perpetuity and preclude them from ever playing a role as an adverse witness when they can't capture them in perpetuity and prevent them from taking the role as an adverse attorney, just, it can't be squared with the rules of professional conduct. It can't be squared with the ability of attorneys to, you know, continue to practice. And it was something that deeply concerned the trial court and was something that informed her ruling.
Judge Cochran.
Help me understand how your position would apply to non-attorney experts. In other words, you're arguing Rule 1.9C should apply to attorney experts.
Yeah.
What rule would you apply to non-attorney experts? Would it be the federal standard that's been applied to non-attorney experts?
So I think that would be an appropriate test. We also couldn't find a lot of, case law in Minnesota applying that. You know, dealing with non-attorney experts. The reason I think that makes sense for non-attorneys is because there are many, many instances, and you see it in your review every day, where experts opine and they don't, maybe it's a medical malpractice, they don't need to get any confidential information from their client to talk about what they're testifying in the case. So that first threshold of was there even confidential information that was part of that prior expert testimony is an important part of that.
Allow attorneys to be experts in situations where non-attorneys couldn't be experts. If you applied the professional rule to attorneys and the federal standard to non-attorneys.
Because the relationship part might not be as tight?
Well, because under Rule 1.9C, the lawyer has to use information relating to representation or reveal information relating to the representation. And under the federal rule, you're disqualified simply by being in a confidential relationship and having, and the party that you were in the confidential relationship disclose confidential information to that expert.
Relating to the...
Right. So it's the disclosure of the confidential information is enough to disqualify you under the federal standard, but under Rule 1.9... See, that's not enough. You have to either use or reveal that information.
So one of the opposing counsel made the statement that witnesses aren't expected to compartmentalize information. I'm not aware of any case that uses an analysis in looking at an attorney expert. And that's because attorneys have to learn to compartmentalize information all the time. It's part of our job. We have to understand what's attorney-client privileged and not reveal that to opposing counsel in negotiations and in discovery disputes. So I think that that is the cure for that, is that attorneys, as professional duties, have the understanding of what is confidential and what is what our duties are to our client, and we have the ability to compartmentalize as necessary. So I think that's one response. Go ahead,
your time's expired, but I'd like to ask one question. Well, I guess a follow-up to what you just said. Just as an editorial comment, I'm concerned that we're then trusting that lawyers are going to be police themselves in what Mr. Van Oort describes as a Chinese wall inside the lawyer's head. Seems to be a difficult thing to police. But here's my question, follows up on what Judge Cochran was asking and something that concerned me and seemed I couldn't find an answer to it in your brief. What public policy would support the notion of different rules to disqualify or qualify expert witnesses, whether the individual is an attorney or not an attorney? What public policy would support the notion that the district court's going to apply different rules depending on the person's profession, whether they fall under the professional rules or not?
I would say the unique and trusted relationship between a party and their attorney, that is the reason why the more stringent attorney rules should apply to an attorney, regardless of in the future whether she's a witness or an expert. So I think that that is a basis for...
So if there are other professions that have privileges involved in their professional standards, mm-hmm. court should then go look for those. If it's a doctor-client relationship, doctor-expert, there's different rules of confidentiality, and those rules should apply. And for engineers, you're suggesting that whatever the profession is should be adopted in the district court's analysis?
So I can't tell you a specific case off the top of my head, but I believe some of the cases that do apply what my colleague refers to as the traditional standard, in applying that standard, that is something that the court looks at. The court looks at, are there any professional obligations for the profession of the proffered expert, and do those guide whether there's going to be any conflict? So I think that is something that we see in the facts. I know I'm out of time. I just want to respond to one point that goes to Judge Ross's question about the unique factual circumstances here about this interim role of Commerce Commissioner. I believe Mr. Van Oort said that work never got into the same subject matter. I just had to say, Mr. Rothman worked extensively on the Meadows issue when he was at the Commerce Department. He was helping the Commerce Department in their collaboration with
We understand. Yeah, we understand
okay.
that.
All right.
Okay.
All right. In conclusion, the
Thank
court should
you.
Affirm.
Mr. Van Oort, you have 5 minutes.
Your Honors. On the question of what the standard should be, we're unaware of any court, whether federal or state, that has applied any standard other than the one we're advocating here. This court would be an outlier of one if it applied some different rule than that. We didn't list all of the state courts that have applied this. We didn't cite them all in our brief, but actually the Kendall Coffee article that opposing counsel cites lists a great many of them. There are more than a dozen by now states, so it's not a federal-state difference. As counsel's argument made clear,
have you found any states after the development of this law? Obviously, there are, in fact, federal cases, and even in our federal circuit, that tended to begin with the professional rules, and have now moved to the rule that you're advocating. Have you found in your research any states that continue to apply the professional rules as opposed to this?
No.
Developing rule in the federal courts?
No. I found no court that has applied any standard other than this one that we're advocating that has considered the issue, federal or state. And as opposing counsel's argument showed, they're making the really difficult, they're taking the difficult position that the rules that apply to everybody else should not apply to lawyers. Even though the lawyer's not acting as a lawyer, the fact that the lawyer is not acting as a lawyer is the whole basis for their argument that Rule 1.9A, the substantial relationship from the rules, doesn't apply. They're saying they're not a lawyer, so don't apply the substantial relationship. But then they're arguing that because they're a lawyer, the expert rule that governs everybody else shouldn't apply. And that's just wrong.
So is the traditional standard more expansive than 1.9A if we took out representation? So it said as a lawyer or an expert witness?
No, I think it, as far as I can understand, it's basically parallel. It's a little harder to prove disqualification under what I've called the traditional standard, the expert standard, because under the lawyer standard, under Rule 1.9A, it's presumed that if the subject matter overlapped, the lawyer got confidential and privileged information. Whereas under the expert standard, even when you prove that the subject matter overlaps, you have to prove that they actually did receive confidential and privileged information. That's the one difference. And the difference is because when you were acting as a lawyer before, it's just obvious that you got that kind of information. Whereas if you're an expert before, it wasn't. That's the one point of distinction. And when the cases say we aren't going to apply the same stringent lawyer rules to experts, that's what they're talking about. They say we're going to make you prove the expert previously got the confidential and privileged information. That's the difference. Of course, here when you were a lawyer before, you got it. And there's no dispute about that.
Doesn't this create a broad blanket?
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Doesn't this create a broader blanket where essentially you represented this client, there's not a huge standard or burden of proof to show that you received confidential information, you meet the federal test, generally speaking, you're just going to assume you're out. Isn't that the result?
Only on the same topic. Only on the same issue. If you got confidential information on something else, no, you're fine.
Did the district court then misinterpret the federal standard? Because the district court was concerned that adopting the federal standard would basically result in a blanket disqualification standard for attorney expert witnesses.
Yes, the district court did misunderstand that. And that was the basis for that. We, during oral argument, pointed out the limitation in other places. And I think where the misunderstanding came from is, I said, a lot of the cases that apply this where you switch sides in the same case don't talk about whether the information was substantially related, because of course it is. It's the same case. And sometimes if you read those cases without the context, they only talk about the two elements of confidential information or relationship and confidential disclosure without saying substantially related. But implicitly or explicitly, it's always there, and it should be there for the reasons you're talking about.
So it's your view that this wouldn't result in blanket disqualification of attorneys?
Correct.
As experts.
That's the right way to apply it. Regarding the breadth of this case, you know, regardless of arguments about discovery, the best record, page 20 in our reply brief, we cite docket 166, exhibit C. It lists the 80 policies and procedures that we applied that cover the entire time period of the class and the time period when Mr. Rothman was there. It proves beyond doubt that the policies and procedures are at issue here that he advised on.
You've asked us to decide as a matter of law that Mr. Rothman is disqualified. Why wouldn't the appropriate remedy, if we were to agree with your legal argument, that we remand to the district court to apply the standard that we articulate?
Because it's plain on the face of the record what the result is. You could just articulate the standard and remand, but often it's, as in this case, when it's not judgment as a matter of law, it's not trial, but when the record does not allow any other outcome, and that's plain from what's before Your Honors, as it is here, then it's appropriate for this court just to get to the final result.
Can I ask just one final question?
Yes.
And I should have asked this.
You're the presiding judge.
Respondent's counsel. I guess I shouldn't be asking the lawyer arguing that for permission.
Your Honor, take all the time you want with me.
If Mr. Rothman were to be disqualified, would there be any opposition by Allianz to them replacing with another expert? Would there be any timeliness objections?
It's coming very late on this. I don't think we would succeed on a timeliness objection. I think, though, that it would be appropriate for Allianz to talk about the prejudice that's been caused by the switch late in time, and exactly what the remedy for that would be from the district court, I think, is in the district court's discretion.
So you're not willing to concede the allowance of a substitute expert?
I don't, well, sight unseen, Your Honor. Who knows if they're qualified? Who knows if there are issues there?
Well, aside from qualification.
It's not in the record. In the briefs, there was mention that that the plaintiffs had identified other potential experts.
Yes, they say
they have. What do you mean sight unseen?
Yeah, they say they have done that. There hasn't been a motion to do that. Your Honors, and just to put it to plainly here, I do not expect these courts would allow that the remedy to be the other side going without any expert. I do think that it would be appropriate to consider the prejudice to Allianz from having to have fought this all the way up and down, and whatever the court decides in its discretion to do, I think that's something for the district court to decide.
Seems like you're leaving the option open to argue that they should not be allowed, the plaintiff should not be allowed to substitute expert.
An expert. I don't expect that the remedy is going to be because they're too late, they can't do it. I haven't talked with my client about
Fair
that.
Enough.
I don't want to. I don't want to give it up without talking to them.
Since we're talking about the professional rules, I suppose we don't want to ask you to make a concession you don't have authority to make at the podium.
And I thank you. I think you're out of time. Thank you very much,
Your Honor.
And Ms. Wick, since I am the presiding judge, I'm going to break with decorum and see if you want to address that specific question briefly of what is the status with regard to deadlines in the case and where that stands if Mr. Rothman were to be disqualified.
So that is something we had broached with Allianz's counsel. They would not state that they would not oppose a substitute expert, and that's why we did inform the district court that should she make that decision, or should, we did, of course, didn't know at the time there'd be an appeal, that we would seek leave to substitute. But we think that would deeply prejudice us. We've invested substantial time and resources in Mr. Rothman. He has unique expertise, and I think a much narrower remedy, since they've only identified three paragraphs in the report that they think it would relate to this confidential information they think he still has, that it would be to limit his opinion in some way to preclude testifying on those three points.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? No, thank you. I'm sorry, Judge Cochran.
I have a follow-up to Judge Ross's question. If we were to agree with appellant, do you think the appropriate procedure then would be to remand back to the district court, or should we make a determination?
I respectfully, while you are highly capable, I would say that the most appropriate remedy would be for the district court to apply the different standard to the facts, because she's far more familiar with the case.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. They were very helpful. The case is submitted, and we will be providing a decision within the statutory timelines.